The New Testament reading this morning is from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 2, the escape to Egypt. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he had heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene.
The contemporary reading is taken from the story of Ian Dixon, who was a Presbyterian minister and a lecturer at Knox College in Dunedin until he retired in the late 1970s. He was also an army chaplain during the Second World War. For 50 years, he was married to Brenda, and after Brenda died, when Ian was close to 80, he came out as gay. This is what he had to say about Christmas in particular. "I think I gave something to the gay community myself, I really do. One of my fondest memories is of a Christmas party I went to with a crowd of beautiful gay men. I loved every one of them. The whole lot were anti-church, but they tolerated the fact that I was an ordained minister. And I said to myself that Jesus mixed with all sorts of people, so why shouldn't I? The Christmas tree was splendid. Everyone was drinking hard stuff. Being pretty moderate, I'm not one to do that. The party was as noisy as blazes. As it got to midnight, I knew that if I was going to drive my car, I'd had enough. As I was about to leave, Tony, the host, said to me, 'If I could quell the racket for a while, would you talk about Christmas?' And he quietened everyone down and said, 'Ian's going to say a few words. There's no booing or hooting, but I'm thinking, help, what do I tell these guys?' As they gathered round, I had a sudden inspiration. Suppose Mary and Joseph are coming along Colombo Street here in Christchurch, and Mary knows it's going to happen any moment. And Joseph says, 'We'll try that house over there.' Imagine they're knocking on the door now and asking for help. What would you do?" And Tony said, "I said they could have our bed. There's a lot of laughter and lewd remarks about immaculate conception and virgin birth and ho, ho, ho. But in the end I said, you know, Tony captured the meaning of Christmas. He said, Mary's here and she can have our bed. That didn't happen in the myth about Bethlehem. There was no room in the inn. But Tony didn't say she could have the spare room or a makeshift bed in the garage or somewhere out in the tool shed. He said, our bed, the bed that he and Warren share. That's where Jesus might have been born, and that's what Christmas means to me. Hard as it may be to believe, God wanted to have that kind of relationship with human beings." Half the guys began to cry, and I thought perhaps it was the liquor, but it was something else, and they all got up and put their arms around me and thanked me. Then that was all over, the music was turned up, the party went on, and I went home. I spoke to Ian in 2005 when I interviewed him. He was 93 when he said those words.
For the word in Scripture, from the word among us, from the word within us, we give thanks.
May the words of my lips and the meditations of each of us be acceptable. I'm living in a time when being white and male, and beginning to, in the eyes of the younger people, growing stale, means that I don't have terribly much going for me. While I was in the theological hall as a young man, white or brown, we were being woken up to the patriarchal nature of the church and the way in which Christianity had been expressed and governed the way in which it still had a long way to go for the equality and the full appreciation that male and female were created in the image of God. And if us young men were not waking up to this reality, there were plenty in the class who were prepared to call us out when we slipped up. I'm grateful for that process now, but in hindsight wished that some of the correctors were a little bit more gentle and appreciative of my willingness to take on board these changes. My first Christmases in parish ministry, I focused the Christmas story around Mary and the midwives, Elizabeth. The men I basically ignored because they got mentioned in the scripture readings. And our church has now changed a lot in the last 33 years since my ordination. And I still stand by, and in fact I'm probably stronger in appreciation, that as male and female, we make up the image of God. But I've started wondering, now that I'm in my 60s, and I'm wondering if masculinity may have suffered as a result of these changes. As we challenged patriarchy, maybe we lost something of the masculine. And it's not only in the church. I was disturbed in a conversation I was having a couple of months ago, and I commented about the young men who were going into one of our high schools, and I said something to the effect of, there was none of them had an athletic build. And the person immediately said to me, well, we don't want to promote toxic masculinity. And I thought, how does an athletic physique equate to toxic masculinity? Surely toxic masculinity can come in any body shape. But this person so quickly equated and put down an athletic build as being toxic. The celebration of the masculine physique. I worry that we may have gone too far in blaming and accusing the man. And I've been dwelling on this, and then on the Lessons and Carols Sunday when Jim was leading us, I was confronted with a little picture in the order of service. A small picture of Joseph and Jesus, with Jesus in his arms. Here we have him. A strong man, a physical worker, a carpenter, maybe a stonemason, as a lot of buildings were done with stone as well as wood. And here he is holding in his arms the newborn child of the woman he loves. Here in the nativity scene we have a man who demonstrated his masculinity by protecting Mary and bringing her into the safety of his household. He could have walked away from her. He could have had her stoned. But he didn't. He took her in. He showed her kindness in her hour of need. He showed her compassion in giving her a home. In doing so, he would have faced the assumptions of his community that he had broken his vows to Mary and got her pregnant, or that he was taking on someone else's child. Both ways, he could have lost face, but he stood strong in his masculine strength and took Mary in. At the center of this nativity story, we have a powerful demonstration of masculinity, its strength and its determination to stand against the norms of the day and put the welfare of Mary and her child to the fore. Compassionate strength. So take a few minutes now to look at this and think of the men in your world who have demonstrated their masculinity in this way, through compassionate strength, determined strength, protective strength. What do you need to say to them? Another man in the story is the innkeeper. His house was full, but again was triggered by the call of compassion for this young couple at his door, the stranger in need, and he gave them shelter. When I was homeless, you gave me shelter. In this man, we see another image of masculinity, one that is able to put themselves out in order for the stranger. Joseph did so for the woman he loved. The innkeeper did it for a stranger. And as I reflect on this giving and looking out for the stranger, I think of my grandfather's generation who travelled around the world to protect the women and children and the frail, the infirm of France. We may be able to question the motivations of governments and royal families in the fighting of the First World War. But for many of the troops who filled the trenches and now fill the Commonwealth war graves, they went there for the stranger. They may have hidden this in the bravado of going on an adventure, but the trenches of France were no adventure. They were places where they put their life on the line for the stranger, for others. In the Nativity story, we have an innkeeper offering protection to a young pregnant woman. Echoes of women and children to the lifeboats. When Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan, did he remember the story of his own birth as he introduces an innkeeper to take care of the man who had been beaten up, taking in the vulnerable? Here is a form of masculinity to be celebrated. Did Jesus have this in mind when he talked about sorting of the sheep and the goats, those who provide shelter when I was homeless? When you do this to the least of my people, you do it for me. This is a theme to be repeated in Jesus' life. When Herod jealously forced Joseph to flee to Egypt with Mary and Jesus, as we had in the reading. Again, Jesus' life was dependent on the stranger. We in this congregation pray for refugees each Sunday, the people who are dependent on strangers. So I invite you to take time to reflect on the stranger who has cared for you, where they might have put their life at risk for you, where they spent money on you. Think of the police, search and rescue. Well, not exclusively done by men. These are roles that have traditionally been done down through the ages. And so the next picture is actually from the Good Samaritan story. Take time to reflect. The next in the story are the shepherds. Men's work, especially by night. Now, I'm a sheep farmer's son, and it was rather disturbing for me to learn that the shepherds, were down at the very bottom of the social pecking order as people who worked on Sabbath. Dirty work. They didn't have much chance, really, in the social order of things. It was a job given to those who had fallen. But also there are men in the hills who are free-spirited, alienated from the power structures, gave them a freedom. In this group of men, I see the spontaneous expressions of manhood. Once they heard and understood the message, they take off down into the village to find a baby, to go, to explore, to see for themselves the freedom of being young. One of the poems we had in the Lessons of Carols service had them bounding down the hills and arriving at the stable short of breath. What an image. I'm not restricted to men, but in this case, it is men. It is the free spirit that brings the challenge to the rigid structures of society. It is the same expression of manhood that Peter and Andrew abandoned their father's boat, along with James and John. The freedom to go beyond their own experience, to explore, to see the new possibilities, the sense of adventure. Racing down the hills in order to see a new baby. In the next photo, we'll see the delight in their eyes. Who said the babies were a woman's thing? Men can and do get so excited. The shepherds gave all men permission to take joy in a newborn. That as men, it's okay to get excited that a child has entered the community, that it's worth a party. So I ask, who are the men who have shown you the joy and freedom of spirit, the joy and the ability to celebrate, to be inquisitive? Who are the free-spirited men in your life? And what have they taught you? And now the final group, the Magi, the wise men, the astrologers, the kings, the elders. What wisdom did they see in the stars? What skills did they have? Have we in our scientific world lost a relationship with the natural order that these men had? I remember a story my father told. We were standing at the top of the farm in the springtime, and he said his father could look out over the valley to the hills on the other side and could tell when spring had arrived by the colour of the grass. He didn't have to wait for the scientists or the weather forecasters. He could read the environment. I've been told of stories of indigenous people where the old men and probably the old women could see what was going on, and they could predict how a season would be and grow crops accordingly. They were in tune with nature. Sadly, with climate change, these skills no longer work. I wonder if these men were skilled in mathematics and able to predict the birth of someone special. Or did they have a deep intuition from experience that led them to Jesus? In telling the story, is Matthew telling us something of the need for a close relationship with the natural world? That it can speak to us, that it can be a voice of God. It is interesting that the word wise is associated with these visitors from the East, wisdom. They didn't have the knowledge of the Hebrew Scriptures, but some form of wisdom led them there. In these men, there is a treasuring of those who express their masculinity not in physical strength, but rather in the inquiring mind, the dedication to study, the dedication to observation, but also a commitment to follow their observations to a town of Bethlehem, to the door of Mary and Joseph, to the newborn child, bringing nuggets of gold, frankincense for the ordination, and myrrh, the bitter herb, to anoint the body for burial. They came from one culture to another, with the wisdom of the broadness of humanity, not the narrowness of tribalism. They have commitment for that long-distance travel. They came not to kill a future king as a threat, but to worship and honour him. In these men is a deep masculine wisdom. So who are the truly wise men in your life? Who are the ones you look to for a link to the natural order? Who do you look to for wisdom in your relationship with God? Who are the ones you look to for a deep understanding of our relationship with each other? Will you look to them or sideline them with the description of stale, male, and in some cases, pale? Let us sing.